Until recently, the image of a movie audience wearing 3D glasses was something we associated with the 1950s. But now, as a result of the great success of Avatar, 3D films are once again likely to be coming to a theater near you. So today on Please Explain, we're going to be talking about 3D technology, how it works, and how our eyes and brains and bodies respond to it. I'm pleased to welcome to today's show Phil McNally, the Global Stereoscopic Supervisor at DreamWorks Animation, whose projects have included Monsters vs. Aliens, Shrek, and the upcoming How to Train Your Dragon, and by Dr. Lawrence Cormack, an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Hi there. I'll be here.
Phil, if we have sight in both eyes, don't we automatically see in 3D?
That's absolutely right. We see in 3D every day, every morning we wake up, hopefully. Very few percentage of people who don't see in 3D, normally because of one eye isn't working for some reason, but really, we see in 3D every day.
So is 3D vision the same as stereoscopic vision?
I tend to use the two terms interchangeably. I tend to use stereoscopic if I'm being slightly more technical, but, I think for the general purpose of 3D movies, 3D is what most people understand to be a stereoscopic movie.
Now, Lawrence, most humans have been looking at two-dimensional images since the creation of cave paintings. Is there something that occurs in our brain that allows us to translate two-dimensional images into something that suggests 3D?
Yeah, the images on the back of each of the retina of your eyes are inherently two-dimensional. They're much like a movie on a movie screen, and the brain has special purpose mechanisms to take these two images and interpret the slight differences between them, which we call disparities, into a very compelling three-dimensional percept of the world. So what's actually happening when you're watching a 3D movie isn't really any different than what's happening when you're looking at our real three-dimensional world.
So the 3D means the same thing whether we're talking about human vision or movies?
Well, we use the term in a little bit more general way. As Phil just mentioned, he uses the term 3D and stereoscopic interchangeably, whereas the brain actually has a lot of ways to get three-dimensional information out of the environment, and you and your listeners can demonstrate this to yourself by simply closing one eye, and the world doesn't go flat. You can still perceive the three-dimensional structure. It just doesn't have that vivid stereoscopic quality that makes 3D movies so exciting.
In fact, 3D movies seem to be more three-dimensional than the real world, don't they?
They do, and part of that might be just the surprise aspect of knowing that you're looking at a flat screen, but yet there seem to be things coming off the screen at you.
Phil, do filmmakers have to understand a lot about how vision works to create 3D images?
I don't think they necessarily have to know how it works, and it's always a benefit to understand the mechanics of anything like this. But really, at DreamWorks Animation, what we allow is the directors to see the work in 3D right from the start, so that they have to visually understand what they like, but they don't necessarily have to mechanically or intellectually understand the process. But certainly, we're all visual artists, and we like to, what you see is what you get is more our approach. And the more we can put 3D up on the screen, the better everyone gets educated on what they like and what's successful and what hurts, and more importantly, and what not to do.
Well, most people think 3D movies go back to the 50s, but wasn't The Man from Mars made in 1922?
Yes. In fact, my friend Ray Zone has written a history of 3D going all the way back to I thought he'd said it was a movie called The Power of Love, maybe, was the first one. But certainly, yes, I think you're right. In the 1920s were some of the first experiments in moving 3D cinema.
Based on the same principles that we're using today?
Pretty much. And, stereoscopic imaging is actually pre-photography, amazingly. But there were experiments with technical drawings to create the left and right views. But I think most people remember the old stereo cards, which were incredibly popular, over 100 years ago.
And they were novelty items. Weren't the 3D movies of the 50s also kind of novelty? House of Wax, Hondo. I remember in House of Wax, what's his name, Price?
Vincent Price.
He was hitting a ping pong ball out at the audience. There was another movie where a lion came jumping out at the audience, and we were all supposed to scream.
That's right. I mean, I think with any new technology, there's always the novelty use of it because, you know, you can't help but be pulled towards that novelty when you first see it. And in fact, I was watching Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times. You remember the famous one where he's on the production line in the factory? And that was a very early sound, you know, talkie. But it was interesting to see how Charlie Chaplin still behaved as he did in the silent movies and never spoke. And there were also gimmick sound shots, which were where he was sitting playing with a radio and turning the volume up and down. And you could really see how that was purely an excitement about the novelty of the new technique of sound. But of course, with sound, we got past that pretty quickly. And with 3D, we've kind of been stuck in the loop of the gimmick to a certain extent.
Is that why? Go ahead.
Yes.
Is that why Alfred Hitchcock? I'm sorry. Doing phoners is always difficult because we can't give eye signals or hand signals. But I was wondering, along the lines of what you were saying, whether the reason that Alfred Hitchcock's Dial M for Murder, which was made in 3D, isn't shown that way very often is because there was a feeling that you want to get past the novelty aspect with a film that was intended to be a bit more serious.
Yeah, and, you know, I think we really have got past the novelty at this point. Because I mean, I think Avatar was a great example of just using 3D as part of the, you know, the, along with, you know, color and sound and all the other things that we use to control the emotion and story beats in a movie. And that's really what's most exciting about where we are now, that the, you know, we talk about the big 3D boom of the 50s, but really we've already gone beyond what the 50s would last. You know, it was only really 2 years, maybe 3 years, and we're already 5-6 years since the Polar Express and Chicken Little first came out at the start of this boom. So we've actually had a much steadier approach, starting quite conservatively and kind of growing the skills this time as opposed to going all in and poking everyone's eyeballs out for for a short time.
Well, I wonder about how the brain works, Lawrence. Is it the same whether we're watching a 3D movie or just walking through the real world?
It's the same thing. So the bottom line, as was discovered by a scientist named Charles Wheatstone in the mid-1800s, if you show two images to the two different eyes and you make those images correct, then the brain interprets it as the real 3D world.
Is this the opposite to when you get really close to something and you see two images?
Yeah, that's something called diplopia, meaning that you can clearly perceive the separate images in each eye, and that's something that I'm sure, you know, people like Phil work very hard to kind of avoid a lot of in their movies. They try to keep the three-dimensional information in the range where it's comfortable for people to view it.
Now, Phil, when you're working on a movie that will be shown in 3D, like How to Train Your Dragon, for example, what's the first step you take?
Well, very early on, you know, actually at the beginning of Monsters vs. Aliens, which was the first 3D movie for DreamWorks Animation, we did a whole range of tests. Now, you know, you could do it scientifically and measure and all of that type of thing. And really what we did is just put lots of people in a full-size theater and turned 3D up and down until they all shouted stop. And we repeated this endlessly until we really decided from a very kind of a, you know, manual method of what was the range that the broad majority of people could handle. And this is very dependent on screen size. You know, obviously, if you have a separation which causes discomfort on the TV size, when you get to the theater, that discomfort is going to be magnified by the amount that the screen size is magnified. But that's mitigated somewhat by the fact that you tend to sit further back from a big screen and the angle of view tends to be relatively similar. Mm-hmm. But it was very important to really sit down and just look at as many images as we could, and we went through a range of tests where we literally stretched the depth further and further backwards until eyes diverge out slightly to see where that pain would start, and the opposite, you know, we crossed the images over so that we converge closer and closer to that point, and pretty much we found out that in a typical theater, 40-foot screen sitting 40 foot back, about a third of the depth that we can use falls behind the screen, and about two-thirds is usable towards us in front of the screen, and that's a pretty comfortable range. And but we pretty much put the screen somewhere in the middle of our depth, typically.
Now, you're using cameras that have two lenses, right? Is it different when whether you're shooting live-action animation or in what appears to be a version of Photoshop for Avatar?
Sure. We are completely spoiled in the computer graphic world, of course, because although as artists we'd like to talk about cameras, what we're really talking about is just data inside a computer. And because our cameras are virtual cameras, we don't have any problem moving them very close together if we want to reduce the stereo and animating them during a shot. And, of course, we don't have problems with optics of lenses and that type of thing. We have, you know, perfectly, mathematically perfect rays of light bouncing around. So in live action, you do have physical cameras, and it's pretty common to want to shoot with distances between the eyes, which are actually less than human eyes. And with cameras being big objects, you can't physically get them close together. And so there's various ways of getting around that, shooting through beam splitters, you know, where one camera bounces off a mirror and one looks through the mirror, that type of thing. And these are technical problems which, you know, we don't have in computer graphics. And, of course, the other major thing that we don't have is the idea that we have to capture it live. Or, you know, when you get the shot, you've got the shot. But in computer graphics, the animators, of course, are doing the performance, and our actors will repeat that performance exactly over and over and over while we experiment with the stereo and get it really dialed in exactly how we want it. So and we have a great luxury.
And those live-action cameras are huge, aren't they? They have to be a lot larger than normal ones.
Well, you know, they are getting smaller and smaller. A company here that I know, Paradise FX, had worked on a lower-budget film called Dark Country, and they were using, I think they were Iconics SI2K cameras. I hear the name, I haven't quite got it right, I think. But these cameras are, you know, they fit in the palm of your hand practically because the lens and the chip is separate from the recording part of it.
Wow.
And so the camera heads are getting smaller and smaller. And the actual recording of the data, of course, being digital, it's not going to film. You can literally pipe them down a cable into, you know, some laptops on a backpack, and that type of situation is allowing live action cameras to actually get much more in the realm of what we can do in CG. So that's pretty exciting.
Larry, you wanted to add something.
Oh, we've gone through a similar evolution in science where we used to kind of custom draw images or movies individually for the two eyes. Now what we do is we render 3D models in the computer and then generate whatever viewpoint on those 3D objects we wish to show the subjects.
Now, I'm talking with Dr. Lawrence Cormack, an associate professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin, and Phil McNally, who is often called Captain 3D. He is the global stereoscopic supervisor at DreamWorks Animation. And in a little while, we'll be taking your calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Larry, I've read that part of the great appeal of 3D is that parts of your brain have to work much harder to constantly process the complex visual information you're getting, and therefore the intensity of that focus requires a deeper level of attention and an experience of the movie that's deeper and more intense. Is that true?
I'd actually argue the other way around. The primate visual system has been evolving on, you know, the dry land of our planet Earth for a long time, and it's very comfortable in a natural 3D environment. That's literally what it's suited to do. So I think the more lifelike people like Phil make these 3D movies, the more immersive they are, the more natural they are to the visual system, and therefore the more you feel like you're really present. And I think that's where the energy comes from.
Now, I'm sure you've heard about people who say they get headaches. Some people feel nauseous and unsettled watching 3D movies. What's happening to them? Why are some people affected more than others?
Yeah, well, there's a couple probable reasons for this. One is the flip side of good old-fashioned motion sickness. So typical motion sickness, you're in a cabin on a boat, and your visual system is telling you you're in a room, you're not moving. Your vestibular system, on the other hand, is telling you you are moving. So you're getting conflicting information from these two senses. That normally happens when you either ingest a poison or ingest too much of a good thing like alcohol, and your body's response is to try to get rid of that stuff, right? Well, in a very realistic 3D movie, the opposite is happening. Your visual system is telling you that there's all this great motion going on, and probably that you're in a car driving or in a spaceship or something, whereas your vestibular system is telling you, no, you're sitting in a theater seat. It's the opposite, but it's still a conflict between what your vestibular system is telling you and what your visual system is telling you.
Phil,
and the response is the same.
Is that why we have so many competing kinds of glasses for 3D? When I was a kid, I guess it was Polaroid glasses. Now there are these very expensive things where there are alternating lights going on and off.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a range of technology out there, but I think fundamentally they're all based around a digital cinema projector. So I think the stereoscopic experience between the different technologies doesn't change what Lawrence was describing. And I thought that was very interesting to think of it that way, and I hadn't thought about it that way. I tended to think about technically what might be wrong in the movie, which is causing that. But it's true to think like that, that when the movie is technically perfect, you do still have... I normally describe it as the first time someone gets on a treadmill at the gym. Their legs are moving, but they feel unstable. But you do get used to that as well.
There's a second little thing with 3D movies, which is that as you realize, when you simulate an object out in front of the screen, the people have to cross their eyes to see that object. When it's behind the scene, they have to uncross their eyes to look at that object. But the focus of the eyeballs always has to remain on the screen because that's where the image is. This is very different than the situation in the real world, in which when you look at your finger in front of your nose, your eyeballs also have to focus, that is, adjust the blur of the image to be at the plane of the finger. So we're now taking these two things, the focus of the eyes and the direction the eyes are pointing, that are normally coupled, and we're forcing them to decouple. And that's very bothersome to some people. It's not very bothersome to other people.
One more thing.
The good news is that as we age and we get into our 30s and 40s, we can no longer focus our eyes at different distances anyway, which is why we all start to need reading glasses. And so that problem kind of solves itself, one of the few things that actually gets better with age.
And that's why so many people who go to 3D movies are over 50, right?
Well, okay.
We'll take a little break and invite our audience to participate in this. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. My guests are Dr. Lawrence Cormack, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin, and Phil McNally, the Global Stereoscopic Supervisor at DreamWorks Animation. His projects have included Monsters vs. Aliens, Shrek, and now the upcoming, I'm sure you've been seeing the coming attractions, How to Train Your Dragon. We'll be back with them right after this. And we're back on this Please Explain Look at 3D with Phil McNally, the Global Stereoscopic Supervisor at DreamWorks Animation, and with Dr. Lawrence Cormack, an Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. One listener, Paul from Harlem, wants to know how color deficiency affects seeing 3D movies like Avatar. If you're partly colorblind, is that going to affect the way you perceive them, Larry?
It actually doesn't. It's an interesting feature of our brain that these aspects like color and motion and faces are actually processed in different regions and surprisingly are very independent of one another. So a color deficiency should have no impact at all, assuming there's nothing else wrong in perceiving 3D or 3D movies.
So you'll see it in the same kind of color blindness that you see the regular world?
Yep.
What about another listener wonders about a wandering eye?
Now, so that if you've got an eye that you had a problem earlier in your childhood where your eyes don't point the same directions, when you were a baby, your brain at some point decided to just shut off one of the two eyes and use the other one. And that puts you in the roughly 5 to 8% of the population that that just can't see three dimensions from stereoscopic presentation. You have to rely on these other cues for making your way around the three-dimensional world.
Have 3D movies helped neuroscientists understand what's going on better?
They have. In fact, you know, I think you asked Phil earlier whether knowing about the science helped him make the movies. And, you know, other than a scientist inventing the way to present stereoscopic images, the answer is largely no. As he said, he goes by intuition and by feel and by how things look. But we actually end up learning a lot because artists and engineers will discover intuitively these tricks to fool the brain into seeing things in a good way or in a way that's good enough given other constraints like cost and equipment. And then we can look at the way that they were able to fool the brain and understand more about the structure of the visual system. So we kind of get a free ride.
Now, Phil, we were talking about how there was a flurry of 3D movies in the late 50s and then pretty much disappeared with a couple of exceptions, and now we're seeing them again. What happened in the interim?
You know, I think predominantly the problem was with the projection and capture system at that time. Obviously, it was film and analog and large cameras, large projectors, and it was just very difficult to actually get a product that was aligned well enough to be comfortable. And, you know, you can only imagine you need to be one frame out of sync between the left and right eye for things to be incredibly stressful to watch. And really, digital projection has been the key to changing that, and that's what happened with the release of Chicken Little. Was the first digital projection that used a single projector to project both the left and the right eye sequentially, so one after the other at a very fast rate, which really means every pixel is perfectly aligned. So I tend to say that the technology barrier really has come down, and now it's up to the artist to work out, you know, creatively what we can do with the media that we could never quite get to because technology was always just stopping us.
Well, that means that you could just use a regular projector. Don't you have to use a special projector?
Well, actually, the cinema projectors today, which are digital, have the capability of running at 144 frames per second compared to the film projectors, which are actually 24. And so with that capability, what we're able to do is literally flash left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye in the same time that it would have been doing a 24, you know, frame per second projection. And so literally the projector is allowing us to go at a rate which projects 3D perfectly with a single projector.
Our number here is 212-433-9692 if you'd like to join in the conversation. You were going to say something, Larry?
Oh, I was just going to agree with Phil that going to this what's called temporally interlead with a single projector, so one eye, the other eye, one eye, the other eye, as opposed to the old method of two projectors, and in particularly the anaglyph methodology, which is the red-green glasses, which meant you couldn't really have vivid colors in the movie itself. Yeah, I think that I agree that that really has been a big leap forward.
And, you know, IMAX is a theater which still uses two projectors and did a great job using film projectors. But, of course, IMAX is a very high-level experience in terms of their engineering and their, you know, quality control, let's say. Yeah. And so there are still two projector systems out there which are excellent as well. But for the regular theater, the one projector has been key. I was going to say something about Lawrence's, you know, the type of tricks that we do, which
right.
you might be interested in, and that is, you know, sometimes we find there's too much depth in a shot because we're looking over the shoulder of one person, you know, and into the scene.
Yes.
And one of the tricks we do is actually we split the scene up, and we give a different stereo depth to the foreground person, which is not that important. We're able to cheat the depth down so that we reduce the eye strain, but then keep full volume and full 3D on the important bit that the audience is looking at. So that's one of the cheats that we found. We call it a multi-rig because we're literally using more than one stereo rig within one shot. So multiple spaces composited together.
That's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about, and the fact that normal viewers are blind to that says something very interesting about the way the visual system processes information,
right.
or doesn't process it in this case.
We have a call from Justin from Astoria. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have, a question and a comment. I recently went and saw Avatar for the first time, and it was the first 3D movie that I ever saw. And when I went to the theater, I noticed, I put the glasses on, and I noticed they were kind of like sunglasses. Everything was dimmed. And so as I'm watching the movie, I kind of took them off and put them back on, and I've kind of felt like I was losing a bit of the vivid color and bright screen experience of being in a movie theater by having these glasses on and experiencing the 3D aspect of it, which was amazing in itself. And I guess my question is, with these glasses, do we have to sacrifice a little bit of that vivid color and really bright screen and experience in the movie theater?
Was this just his experience, or is this an experience many people have?
Well, you're using polarized glasses, which means they're going to absorb some of the light. They can't be perfectly clear because the way they work is to absorb some of the light, which is polarized in a certain direction. There's no way around that except, A, making sure that the last person to use the glasses didn't leave a bunch of thumbprints on them, which happens, and B, you know, the projectors now are really bright, and so you can compensate for that somewhat just by making the actual movie brighter so that it looks like a normal movie when viewed through the glasses.
Is that something you think about, Phil, when you're...
Yes, and actually, it is true. If you measure the light through the glasses, it's darker than without the glasses. But the good news is we actually spend an amazing amount of time brightening, and we call it color timing, but, you know, adjusting the colors and brightness for the 3D movie so that it looks the same as the 2D movie with the glasses on. So actually, when you take your glasses off in a 3D movie, you're not seeing the movie correctly. You're actually seeing it too bright and too colorful. And so what we try to do is match the 2D movie to the 3D movie with the glasses. They should be the same. But we absolutely would love to have more light. Brighter projectors makes for a more comfortable experience, and I think they are getting brighter all the time. But we certainly work hard to make them look the same.
What happens when you then release them in 2D? I know... these films are all released on DVD, whether it's the old version or the new Blu-ray version. You have to dim the color again?
Actually, we already make multiple versions of the movie at the time of release because, you know, one copy goes to film, one copy goes to digital, one is in 2D, then the other is in 3D. IMAX is a different brightness. So it's actually part of one of the burdens of having multiple formats and trying to make them look the best in each of those formats. And, you know, different theaters have brighter projectors and some of them have older projectors. So I know Avatar also did a lot of work on this, and I heard they ended up making 18 different versions of the same movie depending on where it played and what system it was on. And at DreamWorks Animation, we really work hard at that as well to make the most of every aspect or every different theater.
So that's all in post-production work?
That's right. Literally, we finish the movie and say, right, the movie is technically done. Now, here's the version for, you know, theater one, theater two, you know, the different techniques that we can use to project the movie.
Now, we've had a number of hit 3D movies, but why do you think Avatar has done so incredibly well?
Yeah, it's an amazing, obviously, box office return. But I think... One of the things that really stuck with me, and what I think is one of the most powerful things about 3D, is the sense that you have been to that place, and the sense of being in the jungle on
Pandora immersion
was so strong. And when you wake up the next day, you don't remember it like a movie so much as you remember it like a dream that you can then go and return to, apparently many times, judging by the box office numbers. And I think just the duration of the movie, of being, you know, 2 hours 40 minutes. And the sheer level of visual detail in the movie, which comes from a very large production budget, really made that stick in people's minds more like a dream than it did the normal movie experience. And that's what I find so exciting about stereoscopic 3D movies.
A listener wants to know if you can discuss the relationship of holograms to 3D. How far in the future will holograms replace 3D, or do you think they ever will?
Well, Lawrence? I'm not sure if they ever will because of the technology, but the principle, when you look at a hologram and you see the 3D image, The principle is still the same. That is, the hologram is giving you a different view of the 3D object to each of your two eyes, a view that's consistent with actually looking at the object in the real world. The neat thing about a hologram is that there's many, many of these views stored in the hologram, so you can actually walk around the hologram and get that sense of 3D of going around the object in addition to the stereoscopic sense.
Mike in Tribeca asks, how does it work when a studio wants to convert a 2D movie to 3D? I understand that James Cameron is going back and converting all of his films to 3D, and there's also the upcoming Alice in Wonderland, which was originally made in 2D, wasn't it?
Right. I could get into a lot of trouble if I if I start shouting about 2D to 3D conversion.
It's something you don't love, obviously.
Well, you know, I shouldn't say that, because like any technique, you can do it well or you can do it badly.
Like colorizing a nice black and white movie.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, you could do it well, but here's the fundamental thing with 2D to 3D conversion. It's not that the people who do the technique can't do a good job, because I've seen fantastic conversions. It's the fact that the art wasn't created in a spatial sense.
Right.
So it doesn't have a spatial sensibility, and I compare it very much like saying, here's a great painting, now let's make it a sculpture. And if you really want to make a great sculpture, you want to start with the clay and not start with the paint. And so it can be done, and the actual techniques are going to be very important for movies going forward, just as part of the palette of 3D movie-making techniques, where it's going to be important to adjust the 3D in post-production. But unless you're thinking spatially from the beginning and authoring in 3D, which is what we're really trying to do at DreamWorks Animation, it's impossible to find the opportunity of 3D movies if you're not seeing it in 3D.
My guests are Phil McNally, who's Global Stereoscopic Supervisor at DreamWorks Animation, and Dr. Lawrence Cormack, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin. Another listener wonders about wearing your regular glasses underneath the 3D glasses. Does that put another layer between the experience?
It's what you should do. These are kind of independent things. Your regular glasses are correcting for imperfections in the optics of your eye, the cornea and lens, and you want that to be good. And so that's the right thing to do, is to wear your normal correction and then wear the 3D glasses over them.
And that is my situation as well. Although, you know, we're just starting to see custom glasses being made for 3D theaters, and I don't think we're very far away from being able to get a prescription glass which also has the polarizing filter if you were really as nerdy as maybe someone like myself.
Well, now, of course, at the latest electronics show in Las Vegas, the big thing was 3D TV, which guests to this show made fun of. But I guess that's what's going to happen if people have regular glasses. They're going to have to get prescription 3D glasses to watch those 3D TVs.
Or 3D gaming, which is also going to be a really big thing.
What is 3D gaming?
Video games, but in 3D. In fact, NVIDIA recently generously donated one of their projectors to our lab for our research work, so we can get, you know, the vivid 3D experience in the lab. But that might even beat TV to the punch in terms of getting 3D in the home, as you can play these first-person shoot-'em-up video games in full 3D and really feel like you're in the environment.
But not using your own your regular television, even if it's high definition?
This is a special projector which is capable of producing the high frame rates that Phil talked about, and then having the glasses go on and off in synchrony with the projection.
But certainly the TVs that you were talking about at CES are, you know, the next round of high-definition 3D-capable TVs. Basically share the same quality that they can refresh the screen very fast, 240 hertz, for example, and within that they can fit the left and right frames. And I think something else that will drive, and we haven't really heard about this yet, but, you know, for example, Fuji has made a 3D consumer camera, the W1, and it's a little handheld with twin-lens camera. And I really, really think that along with gaming, that buying a little camera where you can shoot the kid's birthday in 3D and some videos and plug that directly into the TV and see it, I think that's going to be a huge driver if the manufacturers catch on to that idea as well.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you see? I'm assuming, Phil, that filmmakers are thinking about what they're going to be doing in the future. Is there ever going to be a time when we can have 3D where people don't complain about headaches?
I think we're already there for the majority of people. That people did not come out of Avatar and complain about 3D headaches. And with How to Train Your Dragon, you know, we have already been doing many public screenings, test screenings, and, you know, literally zero complaints about the 3D. So I think the technological side of this has passed. There's always going to be some people who are more sensitive, but there's some people who don't like treadmills in the gym as well. But really what's key at this point is the creative opportunity that's opened up here. For 100 years of cinema, you know, we've been adding technological layers that get us closer and closer to a dreamlike experience. And this is a huge door that's opened and closed several times. But the ability to really make a spatial experience is, you know, a totally awesome experience, to use the American phrase. But, you know, this is a huge opportunity, which is great fun.
And if I could follow up on that briefly, the human nervous system is a remarkably flexible thing. So as people get used to watching these things and grow up watching them, I think a lot of the discomfort problems will just solve themselves.
Will we be seeing indie 3D films anytime soon? Or is it still too expensive?
We're already there. In fact, I'm a member of the Stereo Club here in Los Angeles, and Eric Carlin runs a 3D theater downtown, and every month they're now showing independent 3D projects from the club members, and it's amazing to see it at that level, people putting cameras together and going out and shooting their own tests, and I think we're going to see more and more of that.
I want to thank the two of you so much for being with us today for this Please Explain look at 3D. I've been talking with Phil McNally, the Global Stereoscopic Supervisor at DreamWorks Animation, the man who is sometimes called Captain 3D. You laugh every time I say that, but I keep on reading that about you. And Dr. Lawrence Cormack, Associate Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at the University of Texas at Austin. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you
very much.